Please call the next case.
Doe versus Green, Jennifer L. Leffler, Appellants Counsel, T. Wayne Biggs, Appellees Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Leffler, and I'm here for the appellant, Jane Doe. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case involves a sexual abuse of a 14-year-old girl by a 33-year-old Secret Service agent. It was a complex relationship because she thought it was consensual at the time, as many relationships like this are. She did not realize it was abuse, and I think one of the problems here is that the complaint was written as though she did, because it was written after she understood what had been happening to her. But at the time, she certainly did not, and the complaint alleges that she thought she was a willing participant as well. In 2021, after some time passed and she entered psychotherapy, she was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and filed this lawsuit relying on 8.01249(6). That is the accrual statute that allows a person to file a lawsuit after they have been diagnosed by a licensed therapist with something like post-traumatic stress disorder. She relied on the version of that statute that was in effect at the time that she filed, because it was her belief that the accrual statute is retroactive. I think the main question here is whether the accrual statute affects a substantive, the amendment of the accrual statute affects a substantive right, or if it's a procedural right. And I think that that's the main issue I have.
Do you concede that under the pre-2013 version of the statute, she loses?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
All right, well, then let me ask you this question. Are the actions described in her 2009 report to the police sufficient to allege all the elements of the tort of battery?
In her report to the police?
Yes. That led to him being charged with the crimes.
Your Honor, I don't think that the complaint goes into enough information there, and I think that one remedy would be to have an evidentiary hearing on that. As I've talked about in that assignment of error, the 8.01243, I believe it's D, which is the actual statute of limitations for actions of sexual abuse, was amended when she was, I said 18 and a half in my reply, but it's when she was 20 and a half. So if her cause of action accrued when she was 18, that has lapsed, I guess, you know, when she's 20. But if she didn't realize that she was abused until she was 18 and a half, then she could have taken advantage of that amendment to 8.01243D. And there's not enough information to determine when she actually realized that.
I'm trying to come up with a way where her statements to the police lead him to being charged with sexual crimes, that wasn't her statements conveyed that there was a non-consensual touching.
It seems to me that
can't be.
Right. I think that this is just a very difficult thing to legislate, because we have to determine when a victim understands that they're a victim as opposed to a willing participant.
But calling the police would seem to indicate she understood she was a victim. One wouldn't call the police and say, I had a totally consensual relationship with this man, would you?
If your parents made you. You know, that happens all the time. We see statutory rape cases all the time where the young woman doesn't want to go forward, but there is a case that happens because she's had sex with a man who's over the age of 18, and they might even be dating, you know? I've seen people sentenced and become sex offenders for that sort of thing in court. So I think that if we're going to go, I think there's a lot of jumps that have been made for the Court of Appeals to say, we know she was aware that she was of the injury and its causal connection to the sexual abuse on the day she turned 18. I think that's why the statute was amended in 2013, because that's a very difficult thing to pinpoint. And even if her parents made her go to the police because she told them what had happened, even if a friend made her go to the police, does she know that she actually wasn't a willing participant? This is paragraph 45 of my complaint. For many years, Ms. Doe has suffered from feelings of guilt and shame for her perceived willing participation in the sexual abuse. So, one would think that you don't realize you have a cause of action if you're willing to continue participating in it, which we are submitting that she thought that she was a willing participant until she, I don't know when it was. I don't know if she knows when it was, but certainly that's something that I think there needs to be either an amended complaint that alleges those things or an evidentiary hearing on when she became aware of it, instead of just saying we know on the day she turned 18 she knew all these things. I'll go back to the retroactive. So the first assignment of error is whether the statute is retroactive.
Could you address the argument of waiver raised by the other side? Up until, I believe, your reply brief in the Court of Appeals, your argument had been that the retroactivity was connected to the constitutional amendment.
Yes,
and
Your Honor.
And then subsequently you raise 8.011.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that it, in all honesty, it became clear to me in reading the in reading the briefs as they went along, but the main point has been that it's retroactive. The main point has been that this accrual statute does not affect, the amendment of the accrual statute does not affect substantive rights. And so when you do that, we have to figure out, well, does it apply retroactively or not? And I think 8.011 guides us in that direction, but in reality, this court has the question, put aside 8.011, and the real question is whether it's substantive, or it's a substantive statute that affects substantive rights, or it's a procedural statute.
So you concede that at no point was the trial judge made aware of an 8.011 argument?
Your Honor, that's true, but the trial judge also declined to apply 8.01 249.6 at all. I will tell the court, in circuit court, it was kind of like all over the place. We were talking about repressed memory the majority of the time, that 8.01 249.6 only applied to repressed memory syndrome. So I was spending a lot of energy on that. I was spending a lot of energy trying to convince the judge that that this was sexual abuse. I mean, there was a whole, we haven't even talked about that. That was a huge part of their argument. This was one hearing date on a plea and bar where I was responding to what they put in their plea and bar, and the majority of that was whether this is even sexual abuse. So,
granted, there were a lot of moving parts, but
right.
If the trial court nor the Court of Appeals ever had the chance to consider 8.011.
That's, yes, Your Honor, and I would say that this court doesn't need to consider it because the question is ultimately whether it's substantive or procedural.
But that is the 8.01 point.
Right, but if it's procedural and the court, and I've argued all along, from the beginning, I've said it's not substantive, there's no substantive right. And if that happens, then this court has to make a determination whether it applies retroactively or prospectively. And that's something the Court of Appeals didn't, they were focused on statute.
Can't you have substantive legal rights that are not constitutionally vested?
Yes, and I remember that was the question that you asked me in my argument.
I was reading the briefs trying to find if y'all could help me with that, because your 8.011 argument, if you had made it, is conceptually quite difficult, actually, because we throw around these terms so loosely. It's substantive, so we're not going to do retroactivity. What we really mean to say is there's a property right. It is a constitutionally vested property right, certain kinds of things. And certain kinds of things in the legal system are not constitutionally protected rights, but they still could be substantive rights.
Right, and so I would point to some cases that I've addressed in my opening brief. One of them is Kaiser, which talks about how an accrual statute does not create a cause of action. A cause of action is created when it arises. And so the accrual is just determining when somebody can exercise that right, which would be procedural. And the same analysis is made in Cohen, They talk about applying a limitation statute retroactively, saying it was procedural in nature and affects remedy only because it operates solely to extend a limitation period. So when you're talking about when you have that ability to file a lawsuit based on the accrual, it's really focusing on method of redress, which is procedural, and not the substantive right that arises when somebody is exposed to asbestos or when somebody actually is sexually abused. It's when they can, you know, when they are supposed to obtain redress.
Do you agree there's nothing in the amended 801-249-6 that expressly says it's to be applied retroactively?
I agree with that. Okay. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
All righty.
Good morning.
Good morning.
T. Wayne Beggs on behalf of the defendant. I was trial counsel below and counsel at the Court of Appeals level. May it please the court. from the outset, I'm not going to belabor our briefing on the 525 arguments, just to reassert that I don't believe, as we set forth in our briefing, that 801-1 was properly preserved. It was never presented to the trial court. Indeed, there were a lot of moving parts. I would hasten to point out in the appendix, you can see that even after that argument, I supplemented the brief and Judge Budd considered it. So,
assume for the sake of argument, and I'm not implying anything, but assume it were before us. Walk us through it. Is every accrual component of every cause of action deemed procedural by definition under 801-1?
I don't believe so. And the reason I don't believe so, and I guess this is sort of, I know we're assuming that it was presented, but I'm still rather hamstrung because had it been presented at the trial court, then we could have gotten into 1-239, which seems to be in the case law that we even cite within the bodies of the case law, a sort of stopgap from that 801-1 being an automatic retroactive.
I get that point. Why would we be keep saying over and over again these statute of limitations not retroactive unless they expressly says it's retroactive if 801-1 makes them so because they're by definition procedural? But I'm trying to grasp the conceptual boundaries of procedural in this context. The argument that's being made is no, accrual by definition is procedural because it's always going to the remedy issue. And that causes me some pause because there's a lot of issues that go into the remedy issue that are not purely procedural.
I think it should give you some pause, and I think it's wrong even to just direct it head on. My two thoughts on that are, first, as far as Ms. Doe herself, I think that this, what you get out of 249-6 is substantive as to her. Because it's not a, I would submit it's not a pure statute of limitations. It is a set of rights that's specifically carved out for a specific class of person under which she may fall or she may not fall. That would, I think, comes under the, it's not repose, but it's a special statute of limitations. And I think that has some substantive elements to it. Second part, as to Mr. Green himself, this may seem like a remarkable proposition, but I submit to you that the constitutional amendment did not overrule Starnes. Starnes still stands for the proposition that there is a protected, vested, substantive right that someone holds when a lawsuit when the time period to bring a lawsuit has come and gone. The phrase from that case that struck me is that the immunity to the suit is just as important as the right to bring the suit. Now, what the constitutional amendment says is that the General Assembly has the power to override that if, and that is a huge if they choose to do so.
Well, except that part of Starnes would seem to fall under the last sentence of the constitutional amendment. No natural person shall have a constitutionally protected property right to bar a cause of action.
And then read on, to bar a cause of action based on intentional torts described herein on the grounds that the action has been applied retroactively. Has been applied retroactively is the important part of the last part of the Constitution.
Or that a statute of limitations or statute of repose has expired.
I think that has...
Now, that may actually raise some significant federal constitutional questions.
Right.
Could they, if it was a property right, could they take it away?
It is. I would agree with you. I think that what my argument with respect to the constitutional amendment is, it seems to me that this is the language of the people of the Commonwealth, was it gave the General Assembly power to do something, but it has to exercise that power, is my answer to it. And they haven't. And that's, in this case, I do want to acknowledge these are certainly egregious facts. There is no doubt about that. But the General Assembly has decided that even where there are egregious facts, not just here but elsewhere, there is a limit in which limit of time in which a lawsuit can be brought. And in this case...
So sorry to interrupt you again. So the 8.01 one point is, why do we even need the constitutional amendment if that one statute was the meta statute that said, well, every time we monkey around with the statute of limitation or cruel issues, it's just procedural, don't worry about it. It's retroactive.
I agree with you. My conclusion from that statement is that that's not what 801-1
means. The argument
means.
Really just collapses on itself.
Correct. That reading of 801-1 renders the constitutional amendment irrelevant. Because if it's automatic, then we didn't need the constitutional amendment. And in this case, I would submit further. There were two words in this case that if not dispositive, that are certainly important. And those words, in my view, are diagnosis and retroactive. We've discussed retroactive and essentially all that I had to say about that. But as far as the word diagnosis, the reason that is important is what Ms. Doe wants 249.6 to say is that her clock doesn't start ticking until she has received a diagnosis. That's not what it says. And we 100% know that that's not what the General Assembly meant, because in all versions of this statute, and the 6 was enacted in 1991, all versions of this statute since then have contained the word diagnosis two paragraphs up when we're talking about the time, accrual time for asbestos-related cases, mesothelioma, and the like. So when the legislature wants to use the word diagnosis, they know how to use the word diagnosis, and they didn't. The accrual statute that applies to Ms. Doe is the accrual statute that contains the if not then known language. And as far as I wanted to address this concept of understanding, and your question, I think, was a better question than the argument that I was going to make, but we have evidence taken as true from the complaint that she understood she was being touched. She knew she was being touched. This isn't a repressed memory case. She knew that. The Court of Appeals went through various of her allegations in the amended complaint, but just as one example, paragraph 13 alleged Ms. Doe constantly worried about getting in trouble, her lack of control over the relationship, and her parents' reaction if the sexual abuse was discovered. Now, even in terms of this concept of understanding, that's an allegation of a contemporaneous understanding that she was involved in something that other people might deem wrong or that was wrong on some level. But we don't need to really go there, because I think this concept of counsel even not necessarily conceded, but one of her comments was it's difficult to determine what level of understanding would be enough or not enough for the knowledge level element to kick in. And I think that would precisely be my point, that the level of understanding is not workable as a legal matter. I don't know how a fact finder of any kind would ever be able to determine when someone has understood enough so that the clock started ticking. And it wouldn't be it might be a little cynical, but you could think of plaintiffs that would, their testimony certainly would be on the side of, I didn't understand at all times. And that's not the standard. The standard, it's stated in Starnes, it's stated in Haynes, to the extent this is a battery, the injury occurred when she was touched. A battery is a touching. The injury occurred when she was touching. Now, that there might have been outgrowths from that, there might have been other injuries that developed after that, but the touching is the injury, and she knew that. She knew that at the time.
I mean, there's no claim someone was in a coma, in a deep sleep, drugged. I mean, it seems like that might go to those types of situations where someone just didn't
it
understand.
Would. It would. I'd be remiss if I didn't point this out. And it's in the appendix that whatever the development of the language has got us to today, I think in the supplemental briefing that I provide in the appendix with the legislative history, I think it's not a far-fetched to say that when this was first enacted, at least part of what they were trying to reach was repressed memory syndrome. Now, legislative history, I recognize that's not typically something that we look at unless we are convinced that there's just something so confusing about the statutory language that we need to look at it. But it's part of the record here, and it was certainly a motivating factor in this language. The fact of the injury and its causal connection to the sexual abuse, if not then known. In this case, under her own allegations, she knew of this abuse. So the fact that she knew about that takes her out of that second part of 249-6. So as we've already discussed, I don't think 801-1 was properly raised. I would address our complaining witness argument. I think that first thing that I would acknowledge is that between the cross-referencing from 249.6 and the cross-referencing, even within 67-10, it can get confusing. But broken down, in order for Ms. Doe to fall under 249.6, she had to be a complaining witness. 67-10 defines that as a person subject to rape, forcible sodomy, object sexual penetration, marital sexual assault, aggravated sexual battery, and sexual battery. And then in all of these offenses, there's language that establishes that there has to be an element of force, threat, or intimidation, mental or physical helplessness, or being under 13. Now, certainly Ms. Doe's not under 13. There's no allegation of mental or physical helplessness, so we get to the argument regarding force. Ms. Doe's argument is she cites to two cases that basically say if you're under the age of consent, 15, then we're talking about constructive force, and therefore she would meet the definition of complaining witness. My response to that is that reading or that application undermines the statutory language. The legislature has set the boundary for the age of 13 as to when someone cannot give consent in this context. So in that sense, those cases contradict the statutory language. If those cases override this argument, then you've essentially, as opposed to saying under 13, you've rewritten the statute to say under 15.
But isn't grooming a form of intimidation? Just a very manipulative form of intimidation?
It could be on a developed record, but I don't think that would meet the definition of intimidation. If intimidation is as I'm putting you in some sort of fear of action by me if you don't comply with my demand.
Well, how about coercion? That I overbore your will through the grooming activity?
Well, could be, but I'm not sure that would meet the definition of coercion. I think the difference between coercion and intimidation in this context might be the level of threat. But I understand your point. I don't think that would be the normal. Meaning or understanding of coercion in this context. Getting to the end of my time, but just to summarize, none of the statutes that are at issue here have any language that indicate retroactivity. And the allegations in Ms. Doe's amended complaint demonstrate that she was aware of the abuse that the abuse from Mr. Green at the time that it was happening. Therefore, the statute of limitations that applies to her and the accrual statute that applies to her are those that were in effect at the point she turned 18, and her statute comes and her complaint comes too late, and that the plea and bar ruling and the Court of Appeals ruling should be affirmed. Thank you for your time and your attention.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd first like to just address what was ended on about force. They just can't have it both ways where they say there's no force, she was willing, this was her decision, she wasn't coerced or intimidated. And then also say that she knew she was being abused at the time. I mean, it's just, she clearly didn't know she was being abused at the time. She said she was a willing participant. She was coerced, she was groomed, and she didn't understand that she was being injured by somebody else. We're giving her a lot of credit as a 14-year-old or however old she was when the court is attributing these connections to her. In their opposition brief, they pointed out she constantly worried about getting in trouble. These are allegations in the complaint. Constantly worried about getting in trouble. Her lack of control over the relationship. Her parents' reaction if the sexual abuse was discovered. What child who's 14 or 15 years old worries about the lack of control over a relationship, or understands that Mr. Green picking her up from school and attending her soccer games from afar is contributing to her anxiety about the inappropriate nature of the relationship? That is not something a 14 or 15-year-old would say, this is causing me anxiety. That's a lot of credit.
When she goes to the police, she's an adult, is she not?
She is, Your Honor, but we don't know at what point she went to the police, whether it was on the day before her 19th birthday, and if she had come to realize all of this the day before that, and if that was the case, then 8.01243D would apply, and she'd have 20 years from that date. We don't know that. And we also don't know why she went to the police. And that's why I'm thinking there's a huge leapfrog that happened between the day she turned, when the sexual abuse happened, and then the Court of Appeals said, well, we know because of her allegations in the complaint, we know she knew everything.
So how does this work if a child is psychologically manipulated and groomed into believing that some egregious sexual act is actually normative? How do we apply this test to that situation? Believe it or not, there's some cultures around this globe that actually do have that view.
I think first of all, if we look at the way the statute has been amended, these are all considerations that have occurred, and that's why that clause was removed, if not then known, and it's just when it's communicated.
You run out of time, sorry to interrupt again, but so what would we do if it was clear that a 14-year-old or 15-year-old child was so psychologically abused by some person that there was no way to cognitively or emotionally or morally value or devalue what has happened? They were told it was normal. It was part of their culture. It's part of what we do here. How do we handle that in this statutory mix?
I'm not sure I completely understand. I think that's why we, if somebody realizes one day that they have injuries, that they're having problems, and they go to a licensed psychologist, and licensed psychologist works with them and says, you know what, this is what happened to you, and this is why you're experiencing all those things.
Is that the point in time when they realize subjectively for the first time, yeah, this is egregiously wrong what happened to me? I thought that was the way it worked.
It could be, and I think that's why we eliminated that part of the statute when it was amended to its current form, because we really don't know when that transition happens. I've said that a number of times. How do you pinpoint the point in time where you go from believing that you have a boyfriend who is a cool 33-year-old Secret Service agent to this guy was sexually molesting me. I mean, there's no, when does that happen? Does it happen when you're 18? Does it happen when you're 18 and a half? Does it happen when you're 25? I'm not sure when that happened. We could have an evidentiary hearing on it. I'm not sure that would necessarily get us where we need to be, but there has to be some inquiry into when she knew if we're going to apply the former version of 8.012.49.6. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, counsel. This court is adjourned.
All rise.